Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted.
Derek, thanks very much. Thanks for being here, everyone. It's a life goal of mine to preach under a disco ball, so that's one to tick off the bucket list today. We are thinking, as Philip said, about ideas of acceptance and approval today, ideas which I take it any one of us could speak about at some length, because they're such universal issues, aren't they? They're all over our TV screens, so we love to watch with pleasure and scorn as hapless contestants try and get approval from Simon Cowell or Sir Alan or scariest of all, Mary Berry. And we feel safe as we watch because we're not involved in that process. But we can't avoid it for very long. We all know the pressure, don't we, to be socially accepted. It starts in the playground, it goes through school and university, and it continues in the workplace as well. Isn't it striking when people get to university? Maybe you remember this from your uni days, or you're watching your children do it now. People are willing to change how they speak, how they dress, how they walk, how much they drink, in order to be accepted. And professional life too doesn't let up. A life of interviews and probation periods and annual reviews. Any of us could speak at length about acceptance. And generally speaking, we know what you need to do in order to be accepted. But what about when it comes to God? What do you need to do to be accepted by God? Personally, what do you and I need to do in order to know the love and favour and acceptance of our Creator? That is the biggest question we could ever ask, isn't it? And I think here we are rather more confused as to what the answer might be. And so it's great to have this chance to think about it together and to look at these words of Jesus himself in probably one of the most famous of all his parables. And his target audience is announced for us right up front there in verse 9. Do keep that parable open as we look at it. So verse 9, he's talking to people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. That is, he's talking to the kind of people who look around and they think, well, there are lots of people in the world who are much worse than I am. So if only some people go to heaven, then I reckon I stand as good a chance as anyone. And to people who think like that, Jesus tells this parable. It's a parable that features two extreme examples. One very, very good man and one absolute wretch. Let's try to reimagine it in a 21st century version for a moment. Two people walk into church to pray. One of them had grown up as a choir boy. Even through school and university, he was always a regular churchgoer. After university, he travelled to South America and Africa, and he helped building schools and digging wells. Since finding his feet in the professional world, he regularly runs marathons and has raised fortunes for various charities. The other man was very different. He was expelled from school and university. His life now is a string of drunken one-night stands, some of which he paid for. He cheated his way through work. He took credit for stuff that other people did. He got rich on some insider trading, and he got richer by building up a network supplying drugs to secondary schools. People crossed the other side of the road to avoid this man when they saw him coming. He had that sort of reputation, but frankly, he wasn't that bothered. Well, Mr. Squeaky Clean walks into church, goes confidently to the front row, and says in his heart, God, I thank you that I am not like so much of society today. The sexually immoral, the liars, the druggies and the drinkers. I keep the rules, I do stuff for charity, I work hard. The other man creeps in a little late and sits at the back. And even as he walks in, being in this building of worship, he regretted it. He felt so out of place. He'd begun to feel increasingly ashamed of some of the choices he'd made and the person he'd become. And so now on that night, sitting at the back of this church, it all started to overwhelm him. He was racked with guilt. He thought to himself, what have I done? He ran through the story of his life. And for the first time in years, he showed genuine emotion as a tear started to run down his cheek. He put his head in his hands and he thought, I'm going to try praying perhaps. And all he could think to say was, God, I've done so much wrong. Please have mercy on me. Jesus concluded, I tell you the truth, it was that man and not the choir boy who goes home that day justified, righteous, a friend of God. Isn't that shocking? Don't you find it somehow back to front? But that is the way it works in God's kingdom. Jesus summarizes it at the end of verse 14. He says, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. I just want to spend some time today thinking about that key sentence in verse 14. Let's think about each part of it in turn. So the first part, then, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. See, the two men in this story have much in common. Both go to church, both want to be friends with God, I guess, both pray, and both go home. But it is the difference between them that really matters, because only one goes home a friend of God. Firstly, we watch the Pharisee. Jesus' hearers would have expected the Pharisee to be the hero of this story. Pharisees were kind of OBE material. They were clever, they were educated, they were morally upstanding, pillars of society. They were famous for serving the poor and needy, for preserving Jewish culture. They knew their Bibles backwards, they prayed all the time. And so when this Pharisee says in verse 11 that he's not like other men, he's right. He is not like other men. This is like a social worker, a vicar, a local councillor, and a CEO, all rolled into one. It's the kind of man you'd want as godfather to your children or as a husband for your daughter. But for all his religious zeal and all his good works, he makes a fatal mistake. He trusts in himself that he is righteous. Verse 11 again, the Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, extortioners, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. Our translation says, standing by himself, he prayed. It could just as easily be translated, standing, he prayed to himself. Because here's a man who makes a big show of his coming into God's presence, but actually, the person at the center of his world is himself. Even when he's praying, did you notice? He's talking about himself all the time. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all that I get. And make no mistake, this man is impressive. The Jewish law required that Jews fast once a year. So fasting twice a week, he is 104 times more zealous than he needs to be on the fasting front. Giving 10% of everything. He was only required to give 10% of certain things under Jewish law. So you see, this man is saying, God, I take your law and I raise it to a whole new level. That's how good I am. There is no humility before God here. There is proud, self-righteous confidence. Imagine a woman who walks into a doctor's surgery and says, Doctor, I want you to know I am as fit as a fiddle. There are lots of unhealthy people out there. I just walk past some of them, but not me. My body is in perfect shape. And yet the doctor is sat there with the results of an MRI scan that show a lump the size of a golf ball on her brain. She's dreadfully sick and she cannot see it. I lose count of the number of friends who say to me when we come to talk about a kind of where they stand with God, who say something like, yeah, well, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm a pretty decent guy, and I've got the gift of the gab. Me and God, we'll get on just fine. You see, we all think that the good things we do outweigh the bad, that actually there are some real problem people out there in the world. They're God's problem, not me. I'm good enough. But the trouble is, we are not. You see, God's standards are 100% faithfulness. And he wants us to love him perfectly and flawlessly and consistently. He wants us to love one another perfectly and flawlessly and consistently. And which of us, honestly, can say that we've done either of those things? Spiritually speaking, you and I have a lump the size of a football on our hearts. That's why it's so helpful that Jesus gives these extreme examples. By giving us this amazing example of upright religious living, Jesus is saying, if this man was wrong to trust in himself, well then anyone who does likewise is also wrong. Who would measure up if he doesn't? Jesus warns us. He says, I tell you, everyone who does this will be humbled eternally. The Pharisee makes a terrible mistake. And I think here's why he makes it. He thinks he's righteous because he's so busy looking around and looking down on everyone else. Isn't this what we do when we want to feel better about ourselves? You find someone worse than you and you enjoy the feeling of superiority for a little while. So the Pharisee prays, thank you that I'm not like other people. That is typical of us proud people, isn't it? And it's not difficult to do. If I want to feel morally good about myself, I can say I'm not a Jimmy Savile. I can watch news about ISIS and I can think they are monsters and I am a decent human being. I am not the problem, they are. Even in your office, I suspect you find yourself doing this. If you're insecure about your productivity, look around until you find someone less productive than you and you'll feel better. If you feel unpopular, look around until you find the person who's really excluded and really disliked, and you'll feel more loved. Ultimately, though, we are like people in an intensive care ward arguing about which one of us is sicker, and we don't see the stupidity of it. C.S. Lewis said this. He said, a proud man is always looking down, and when you're looking down, you cannot see above you. That is, you cannot see the God who is above you. We are not as good as God, and that's what really matters. The story is told of a Sunday school class where they studied this passage, and at the end of the session, the Sunday school teacher said to the children, now children, let's pray, let's thank God that we are not like this bad Pharisee. And we tend to smile and laugh at that story, and then we thank God that we are not like that bad Sunday school teacher. And so we make the same mistake all over again. And it's so easy to do, but it's so serious. Jesus warns us where this road leads. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, by which he means you will be humbled by God eternally. But wonderfully, the sentence doesn't end there, because he also says, secondly, the one who humbles himself will be exalted. That's our second point. And so we meet the tax collector. And no one likes tax collectors in any age, in any stage in history. I guess that's why Philip Hammond felt compelled to make so many jokes when he was making his budget speech, some desperate attempt to be liked as Chancellor. Good luck with that. No one likes tax collectors, but in Jesus' day, the stakes were even higher. Apparently, it was not uncommon for tax collectors to be attacked or spat at in the street just as they walked around. Tax collectors were seen as collaborators because they took money from their own people and gave it to the Roman oppressors. And they were seen as corrupt because as they did that, they lined their own pockets and got rich. And they were seen as blasphemers because they ignored the Jewish God and they acknowledged Caesar as Lord. In other words, socially and spiritually, these people are bottom of the pile, known and despised by everyone. And then one day, this tax collector goes into the temple, verse 13. The tax collector stood at a distance. He wouldn't even raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. He may have been hated. He may have been an outcast. But he gets one thing, two things right that day. And as a result, he goes home as an eternal friend of God. And so he's here as an example to us. Notice first how he admits his failure. Here's a man who admits his failure. The Pharisee, we are told, strutted to center stage in the temple. This one stood at a distance. He wouldn't even raise his eyes. Such was his awareness of his guilt. Instead, he stands there beating his breast, overcome with grief and regret. And when he prays, he doesn't list off his own virtues or achievements. Just seven simple words. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. In fact, it's even stronger than that in the original language. Literally, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. See, this man is so busy seeing his own guilt, he hasn't even noticed other sinners around him. It's me, God. I am the sinner. One of the things that entertains me when I go on holiday or even when I'm back home in Portugal is spotting bad English on menus and signs and things like that. I wonder if you do that sort of thing. So there's a doctor's surgery in Hong Kong that advertised itself as a specialist in women and other diseases. On a Spanish plane, there was those paper air sickness bags, which you don't see so much these days, but it said bags to be used in case of sickness or to gather remains. Which is a little bit morbid as you settle in on your way to on holiday. But I heard recently of a sign in China, which in a normal English translation on English building sites or something would have read, mind your head. You know, the kind of low-lying beam or something, mind your head. But the translation in China, wonderfully, read, the lower, the safer. The lower, the safer. Very wise words. And words, actually, which are so applicable to our standing before God. The lower, the safer. Here is a man, this tax collector, who stoops low such that he's able to admit his guilt before God. But the important thing is he doesn't stop there either. Christianity is not a miserable religion that forces you to wallow in guilt and wallow in misery. Christianity is a message of joy because of what this miserable man is able to say next. He doesn't just admit his failure. Secondly, he asks God for mercy. Oh God, have mercy on me. Just one request. He's not just saying sorry. He's not promising just to turn over a new leaf and try a bit harder. He's saying to God, I know that you're angry with me. And you should be. And I know that I need you to find a solution. A solution cannot come from me. I'm too far gone. If there's any hope for me, it has to come from your mercy. Now, I wonder if we pause the story right there. Do you think there's any hope for this man? Maybe you, have, at times in your life, have got to a similar point where you think, is there any hope for me? Surely I am too far gone. But the wonderful news for tax collectors the world over, and for you and for me, is that God is a God of mercy. And so just a few days after telling this parable, Jesus will allow himself to be arrested and beaten and crucified. And the Bible says as he dies, he's taking on himself all of God's anger at my pride and yours. All the anger that people like this tax collector deserve. Jesus was opening up the floodgates so that mercy can flow. So that the answer to that question is, yes, I will have mercy. Yes, you can be forgiven. Yes, you can have a fresh start. Even the worst of sinners. It's wonderfully simple, isn't it? Have you asked God for mercy? If you have, if you were to do so today, you could go back to your office justified. God's mercy would take every sin, every wrongdoing from your life and load it onto his son on the cross. It sounds too good to be true. But don't take it from me. Take it from the lips of Jesus himself. He uses the word justified. Justified. It means perfect in God's sight. It means to be known and loved and accepted by God. And the only qualification you need to pray this prayer is to be a sinner. The lower, the safer. Will you go low enough to say that you're bad enough to pray such a prayer? I fear some here today might say, well, why does it have to be like this? I'm an achiever in life. I like to stand on my own two feet. I suspect many hear this story and we think, well, I don't really want to associate with either of those people. I don't want to be like this Pharisee, but I'm not quite such a wretch as the tax collector. We want a kind of third British decent man in the middle who we can copy. But there are only two options. It's very stark. Each of us has a choice, either to trust in ourselves or to trust in mercy. One of the striking things in Jesus' summary in verse 14 is that there are two fixed marker points in every human life. There is an exaltation for everyone, and there is a humiliation or a bringing low for everyone. The only thing that changes is the order of those things. So let me ask you, which humbling sounds worse? A voluntary one now, which I do myself, where I stop pretending, where I come clean with God and ask for mercy? Or a forced one later, which God does to me for all eternity? And which exaltation sounds better? I can exalt myself now, and I'm sure there's some very able people. You will be able to exalt yourself quite highly in this life and enjoy it for a while. Or the exaltation that God will give you with all his power and all his strength for all eternity. Can I commend to you to humble yourself now and be exalted by God for eternity? Here is God offering you a way out of the eternity that we deserve, offering you mercy instead, and promising to exalt you forever. It is the best invitation we will ever receive. Thanks very much for listening.